Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the media call facts about the Kermit Gosnell trial. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time you need to reach an operator, please press the star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, April the 16th, 2013. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jody Jacobson. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Christy. Really appreciate that. Everyone, welcome to today's call. I'm Editor-in-Chief of Arch Reality Check, and I want to welcome you to today's call, as well as first start out by thanking my colleagues, particularly Brady Swenson and the rest of our team for putting this together on such short notice. It takes a lot of work to get these things together. I also want to pre-thank our speakers today, who I'll introduce in a moment, because they too have put aside other things to be on this important call. We are going to introduce the speakers briefly before they give their remarks, and then after that open up for questions. We will not, and I'll say this again, will not tolerate anyone who seeks to disrupt the call by taking over the conversation. So please be mindful and respectful of everyone. So this call today is to provide some facts behind the Kermit Gosnell case, which is getting attention in the media. Our feeling is it's not whether to report about Kermit Gosnell, but how you report about it, and whether or not you understand safe abortion care and the difference between safe abortion care and women's access to safe abortion care and what a person like Kermit Gosnell represents. I can say from my own experience, and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and in India, when access to safe abortion is not available, women die. And what we are seeing in many states of the United States is a constant stigmatization and discrimination of abortion providers and women, and a constant push to further and further restrict safe abortion care as health care. And in these kinds of instances, people like Kermit Gosnell flourish. So we want to give you facts in order to be able to report responsibly on this issue. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm first going to introduce our speakers briefly. We have a set of their full bios online, but so as not to take up time extensively going over them, I'll just briefly tell you who they are. First, we have Carol Jaffe, who's a professor at the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. And her and my esteemed colleague, Tracy Wheat, who is also at the University of California, San Francisco, and a preeminent researcher on safe abortion care. We have Jessica Gonzalez, who is the president and executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health and an expert in the Hyde Amendment effects on women of color and Latina women particularly. We have Deborah Reed, staff attorney at the National Health Law Program and a board member of the Black Women's Health Imperative, who is herself an expert on women of color and their access to safe and good quality health care. And then finally, we expect to have Tara Murthos, a senior writer at the Philadelphia Weekly who has been covering Gosnell for a couple of years, join us on the call. I don't know that she had been able to get on the call quite yet, but we expect her to join. With that, I'm asking each of our speakers to take about 5 minutes to speak to their issues, and then we'll open for questions. So I'd like to introduce first Carol Jaffe. Carol, will you go ahead and give your remark?
Yes. Well, thank you, everyone, for participating in this call. Let me just start off with some facts about the Gosnell case as I see it. And the first question is, why did this tragedy occur, and how is it related to regulation, which has become the subject of so much focus on abortion nationally? And the take-home message here is that this tragedy did not occur because of insufficient regulation, but because existing regulations were not followed by that clinic, and there was a massive failure of oversight. Various whistleblowers, including other Pennsylvania abortion providers, repeatedly tried to call attention to what happened in that clinic without success. I mean, the second question I'd like to address is, why did women go to that particular clinic? And there's several reasons. I think the main one was that Gosnell's prices were lower than other providers in the area. And what I have learned over the years from talking to many abortion clinic directors is for desperately poor women, even a difference of $10 or so can make a difference where they decide to go for an abortion. And the prices listed in the grand jury report that Gosnell charged were substantially lower than those charged by other people in the area. For example, he charged $330 for a first trimester abortion, which was at least $100 less than other people in the area. Similarly, for a later abortion, those occurring around 23, 24 weeks, his price was $1,600, at least $700-$800 lower than other people in the area. Now, some portion of his clients existed in a typical vicious cycle that affects many poor women. By the time they can scrape together enough money for an abortion, they become past the period by which they can legally obtain an abortion in Pennsylvania. And also in neighboring states, Gosnell had many patients from Maryland as well. And as we know, Dr. Gosnell did not obey Pennsylvania law. Women who were over the legal limit knew they could still go to him. And finally, in a very sad irony, some women, according to press accounts at the time, were afraid of the protesters they saw at Planned Parenthood in Center City, Philadelphia, and his clinic attracted less attention. Now, since the Gosnell tragedy became clear, the state of Pennsylvania has taken what actions that I can only see as unnecessary and counterproductive. The legislature has imposed a law requiring abortion-providing facilities in the state to conform to the physical requirements of ambulatory surgery centers. This has meant that clinics have had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on upgrades that have nothing to do with patient safety and, in fact, have achieved the real goal of shutting down a number of clinics. Before the Gosnell tragedy, there was 22 abortion-providing facilities in Pennsylvania. Now, apparently, there are only 13. Pittsburgh used to have 4 clinics. Now they are down to 2. We don't have time to get into the whole safety of abortion, which is a whole other topic. I do want to mention to you, however, that one of the leading medical researchers in this field, Dr. David Grimes, has recently published a paper showing that abortion is 14 times safer than childbirth. And I will be very happy to make this reference available to anybody after this call. So to conclude my remarks, the overriding message to be taken from the Gosnell Clinic tragedy is that as long as abortion is kept separate from mainstream medicine and Medicaid does not pay for the abortions for poor women as it does for other medical procedures for this group, there will always be these rogue clinics that prey on the most vulnerable women. Ironically, one of the community health centers, reputed to be one of the best in Philadelphia, is located in West Philly, very near to where Gosnell's former clinic was. But this clinic, because it received federal funds, was not able to provide abortions. So my very depressing take-home from this case is that I fear that these tragedies will continue to occur. We will eventually see more people similar to Gosnell unless abortion is made accessible to all women in this society, including the most poor. Thank you very much.
Carol, thank you so much for those comments. I want to ask if Tracy Weitz has anything to add at this moment. Okay, perhaps not. Jessica, would you?
Sorry, I was on.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry about that. Thank you for having me, and I will just add a couple of remarks, and then I look forward to the question and answer period. I wanted to reiterate Dr. Jaffe's point about the quality of abortion care and what we know from 2 decades of research about what improves safety. And unfortunately, what improves safety to abortion care is increasing the availability of training so that people who come out of medical school actually understand what the standards of care are. It is clear that Dr. Gosnell was not operating up to the standard of care. And as Dr. Jaffe noted, we are in a reversing trend where more states are restricting the availability of abortion training to trainees in their institutions if those institutions receive public money. The second thing that increases safety to abortion care is increasing access to abortion care. And so when we know that when abortion is done earlier in pregnancy, it is safer. Even later in pregnancy, it's safer than childbirth, but it's made even safer when it's done earlier. The regulations that have been imposed in Pennsylvania are doing just the opposite, restricting access to care, which we do know from research is likely to lead some women to seek care later in pregnancy. So I look forward to having more opportunities to answer questions about safety or about the current quality of abortion care. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tracy. Jessica Gonzalez, I'll ask you now to take over and provide your talking points.
Great. Thank you for having me on this call. I am the executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, and we're the only national organization working for and behalf on the reproductive health rights and justice for the nation's 24 million Latinas and our families and our communities. So like most people, I was really horrified to hear the story of how Kermit Gosnell exploited women's desperation, and my heart really goes out to the women and the families harmed by this terrible action. I want to reaffirm that Kermit Gosnell is a criminal and that he deserves to be brought to justice. But I do think it's important to place these events in context to understand why a woman may be vulnerable to this kind of exploitation. There's a myth in this country that unsafe, illegal abortion was altogether eliminated after the Supreme Court made Roe v. Wade the law of the land. But unfortunately, the anti-choice restrictions put in place since Roe that make abortion less affordable and harder to get and have created conditions in which some women remain vulnerable to an unscrupulous person like Gosnell. And in fact, the first woman to die of an illegal abortion in this country after Roe v. Wade, was Rosie Jimenez. Rosie Jimenez was a 27-year-old Latina college student who became pregnant after Roe made abortion legal. She qualified for Medicaid, but because the Hyde Amendment had gone into effect 2 months earlier, she could not get insurance coverage for an abortion, and she could not pay for it herself. Rosie was 6 months away from graduating with a teaching credential, a ticket to a better life for her and her daughter, who was just 5 years old at the time. Unable to raise the money to pay for a legal abortion, she turned to an unsafe and illegal procedure. And in October of 1977, Rosie died of septic shock and was the first known victim of the Hyde Amendment, and a painful reminder that legal abortion means little to a woman without the ability to pay for it. The legacy of the Hyde Amendment, a policy passed every year that denies poor women access to safe, legal, high-quality providers, is a legacy of disempowering women and endangering their lives. The continuation of policies like the Hyde Amendment and policies that make it needlessly difficult for the vast majority of abortion providers, who are generally compassionate and well-trained professionals, to do their work, all but guarantee that there are and there will be more stories like Rosie's. Stories like those of the women who sought out Gosnell, women who are lured by these low prices and false promises, shamed by abortion stigma, whose desperation was taken advantage of. We know that Latinas today face a daunting array of systematic barriers to accessing reproductive health care, including lack of insurance coverage, lack of adequate funding for comprehensive sex ed, discrimination, obstructive immigration policies. More than one in four Latinas live in poverty, and that's twice the rate of their white counterparts. Moreover, Latinas are twice as likely to experience unintended pregnancy and twice as likely to get their insurance from a public source. So every day my organization works to ensure that Latinas are informed and empowered to demand their rights to protect their health. The vast majority of abortion providers are compassionate professionals who offer women a critical service, despite the fact that simply being an abortion provider makes them a target, and we support these providers and their important work. But one of our most important charges is to reverse policies like the Hyde Amendment, which take the power and the ability to make decisions away from a woman and leave her at risk. A woman's ability to have a safe, legal abortion from a compassionate, trained provider should not depend on how much money is in her pocket. Every woman deserves the dignity of making her own decisions about her pregnancy, and she deserves our support and care, whatever that decision may be. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for those incredibly eloquent remarks. Can I then ask Deborah Reed to provide your comments?
Sure. Thank you, and thank you very much for having me on the call. And my name is Deborah Reed. I'm a senior attorney at the National Health Law Program, and I also serve on the board of directors at the Black Women's Health Imperative. The Imperative is the only national nonprofit organization committed to improving the health and wellness of our nation's Black women and girls. And, again, I would like to just underscore, just like Jessica, we at the Imperative and the National Health Law Program are just horrified and outraged over the Gosnell case and the circumstances under which the women were confronted when they're trying to find a safe abortion services. And also, we are particularly outraged by those other cases of similar situations that we don't know about. So that just underscores the need for safe and affordable abortion service and access to contraceptive services as well. We know that women of color, and Black women specifically, are more likely to be low-income, uninsured, or underinsured, or receive their insurance through the government, such as through Medicaid. And we also know that approximately two-thirds of pregnancies in the United States experienced by Black women are unintended. That issue just points to the need for comprehensive reproductive health services that are safe and affordable for all women, but particularly for low-income women and women of color. Women need access to the entire spectrum of reproductive health services, and that includes abortion services, to meet the appropriate standard for women's health, particularly if they're experiencing chronic health conditions. And this analysis was done in the National Health Law's publication, Healthcare Refusals Undermining Quality Care for Women, and a co-editor is Tracy Wheats is on the line if you have questions about that. But it just points to the fact that abortion should not be excluded from the range of health care that women should have access to. And unfortunately, it's sized and just like contraception has been of recent days. So that should not be if women should be getting the appropriate standard of health care. And we also know that the quality of care that communities of color have been receiving can be less than standard, as demonstrated in this case. For example, the Institutes of Medicine had a study committee in 1999 in preparation for their report on equal treatment that demonstrated that African Americans and Hispanics tend to receive a lower quality of health care across a range of areas and clinical services. And also, African Americans are more likely than whites to receive less than desirable services. Unfortunately, the study was done in 1999, and we could see from this case that's indeed the situation. Just taking a look at the grand jury report for this case, we see that patients received treatment that was unethical and unsafe. They were administered treatment, if you can call it that, through untrained staff, and Dr. Gosnell himself was not an OBGYN. So this was clearly a case of a bad doctor. The issue then becomes, why was this doctor allowed to practice? And the question becomes from that, would more oversight had taken place if another type of health care other than abortion was being provided? Would the appropriate oversight have been taken place if his patients were more affluent? That's a question that people should be focusing on. And another issue that's unfortunately impacting African-American women and other women, too, are intimidation tactics when women seek abortion services. We've seen that on with the billboard campaign in Atlanta that equated black women seeking abortions as committing genocide, and therefore black children were in danger. Those type of tactics aren't done for any type of other health care other than abortion services. That's an additional barrier, in addition to the cost factor and the accessibility factor. The intimidation factor is also there facing a number of women. So I would just like to close by saying what the issue that we should be looking at, in addition to what happened to the oversight, is how many black women and other low-income women and women of color face barriers to affordable, safe, and accessible contraception, including abortion, that's available in their communities. Our efforts should be joined together to make sure that's being done and that is appropriate for every woman. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Really appreciate that. Tara, are you on the line?
I am.
Hi. Okay, great. So our last speaker today is Tara Murtha, and I'm going to ask her to give her comments, and then we'll pause for a second to pick up questions. So, Tara, with that, would you go ahead and give your comments?
Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Tara Murtha, and I'm a senior writer at Philadelphia Weekly here in Philadelphia. And I can tell you as a local journalist that the idea that prominent national journalists, some of them, missed or more accurately dismissed the Gosnell story is surprising and shocking that it's being blamed on, you know, a whole sort of media liberal conspiracy. But that's a distraction, and now that there is more attention, let's focus on the politics that led to the crime and the politics that have taken place in the wake of the grand jury report. Here in Pennsylvania, it was a really ruthless political battle in the wake of Gosnell to pass a bill that mandated that Pennsylvania clinics upgrade to the to adhere to the standards of ambulatory surgical facilities. And as a result of that, depending on how you count, whether it's 20 or 22, two are sort of linked to hospitals, freestanding abortion clinics offering surgical abortion services in Pennsylvania. The latest count is 13, and I'm going to call the Pennsylvania Department of Health to double-check that nothing has changed in the last couple weeks. But so clinics have shut down in Pennsylvania as a direct, it's not even, you know, it was called, Gosnell's name was said all throughout the arguments on the floor. So clinics in Pennsylvania were shut down as a very direct result of the exploitation of the Kermit Gosnell case. As many of you know, trap laws have been a part, you know, part of the anti-choice strategy for a long time. And as Dale Steinberg, the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania, explained to me, it had been a topic in the Pennsylvania legislature, a goal of the Pennsylvania legislature, which is, of course, conservative, for a very long time. And the Gosnell case, you know, galvanized that movement. It enabled them to camouflage, you know, an anti-choice tactic as a concern for women's health and safety, when, of course, it's having the opposite effect. And, in fact, what's really chilling about that to me is that, you know, no medical associations in Pennsylvania supported this bill, and, in fact, several came out directly opposing and criticizing the bill. It was, however, supported by religious organizations such as the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference. As a result, Pennsylvania's regulations right now, the bill and what's currently happening, you know, echoes Kermit Gosnell's strategy to an extent. You know, Kermit Gosnell was ruthless in his reliance on the expectation of stratified health care by socioeconomics, by race, by class. Literally, the amount of money that you had to give him determined how much pain you would endure during his procedures. What hasn't been reported on very much is that he had a chart where patients could, a la carte, choose how much painkiller and medicine they would have, and the more painkiller, the more that it costs. And that is, in the big picture, the what it's looking like in Pennsylvania in general and beyond, but I'll get to that in a minute. In general, the less money you have, the worse your quality of health care will be. I attended and reported on the opening arguments of the trial, and the basis of Kermit Gosnell's defense is that, sure, Dr. Gosnell may not be, I believe his attorney, Jack McMahon, phrased it, the perfect doctor, but for poor women of color to expect high standards of care in an impoverished neighborhood in Philadelphia is unreasonable. I don't think that's unreasonable. And I'm just glancing. If you recall, what's interesting to me is if you recall during the presidential election, a legislator here, Representative Mike Terzai, had gloated at a meeting that voter ID, which was a huge story, of course, was actually being proposed in Pennsylvania to secure Pennsylvania for Mitt Romney. The sentence before that infamous sentence was that Pennsylvania passed the first pro-life legislation in 22 years. That was in the same clip, and he was referring to the trap law that was passed in Pennsylvania. I had interviewed Elizabeth Nash at the Guttmacher Institute, who told me that she knows personally that the Kermit Gosnell's name has been invoked in Utah and other states, but there's a ripple effect here. And it has been reported that the Virginia, similar legislation in Virginia has been also, Kermit Gosnell's name was used as a straw man to pass those as well. So from my point of view, the exploitation of the case, political exploitation of the case, is the story at this point, and not the politics of conservative versus liberal media. You know, the grand jury report very distinctly says that Kermit Gosnell is a result of politicizing abortion. After Governor Casey, who passed the Abortion Control Act, which of course laid out the blueprint for state-level restrictions to abortion, the next governor, Governor Tom Ridge, was so he didn't want to deal with abortion whatsoever because it had been so politicized. So he either made or approved a woefully, awful decision to not inspect abortion clinics at all. So it's laid out. 58 witnesses were interviewed over the better part of a year, and it's been determined that it's politicizing abortion that led to Kermit Gosnell. The series of ignored red flags is a combination of that and general dismissal because the victims were largely poor women and largely poor women of color. That's my point of view, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks so much, Tara. Christy, I am going to now ask you to take over questions, but I want to reiterate something that I said at the beginning of the call because I know some others have joined us. We welcome any questions about this issue, but we will not tolerate anyone trying to take over the call or monopolize the discussion. So please be respectful of both the speakers and the other participants on the call, and ask your questions and leave time for them to be answered. But if you do seek to hijack the call, we will have you muted or taken off the call. Thank you so much. And with that, Christy, would you go ahead and entertain questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. Your line will then be accessed from the conference to obtain information. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And if you are using a speakerphone today, please lift your handset before entering your request. Our first question comes from the line of Tim Carney from the Washington Examiner. Please go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my question. So Gosnell is on trial not for violating cleanliness standards, but for killing people, including one mother and many babies. So do you think that delivering the babies and then snipping their spines or whatever he did, is that abortion? Is that murder? What is the distinction between what he did and, say, what a late-term abortionist like Leroy Carhart does?
Thanks, Tim. I'm going to direct those questions to Carol and Tracy, unless they are otherwise inclined to ask someone else to answer them.
and then we'll go on to the next question.
Carol, I'm happy to take that one.
Okay, you go ahead.
Sure, this is Tracy Weed. So I'm an associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and I study abortion in the United States, and in particular, late abortion. I think it's important to recognize that this particular procedure is nowhere in the medical literature. When a procedure that usually involves the collapsing of the skull is done, it's usually done when the fetus is still in the uterus, not when the fetus has been delivered. So this technique that he does is nowhere in the lexicon of practice in abortion care. So in terms of thinking about the difference between the way abortion providers who do later abortions in the United States practice and this particular practice, they are completely worlds apart. Traditionally, when that procedure is done, that which involves the collapsing of the skull, it's done at the junction between the later second trimester and the beginning of the third trimester. That's around 24 weeks. It is not done at this significantly later period. When inductions for delivery, that is, in the third trimester when procedures are performed, when abortions are performed, they're usually done as inductions. That is, they look much more like a labor and delivery. And the fetus is traditionally euthanized before that procedure is initiated. Two drugs, either potassium chloride or digoxin, are used to make sure that the fetus is not living before the procedure is initiated. So the take-home message is that later abortion is a very sort of complicated and I think emotionally highly charged discussion point, but the way in which this practice was done has nothing to do with the way in which the standard of care and later abortion procedures are performed in the United States.
Yeah, and this is Carol Joffe. I, too, am a sociologist who has studied abortion provision for many years. I would just add to what Dr. Weed said is that if you read the grand jury report, one of the staff people at Gosnell's clinic mentioned that he tried to master the technique that Dr. Weitz just mentioned of injecting digoxin to cause fetal demise before the procedure, but he basically couldn't figure out how to do it. So yet another confirmation, going back to what Dr. Weitz said earlier, of how incredibly important it is to have adequate training, which clearly Dr. Gosnell did not get.
Thanks so much, Carol and Tracy. I'm just wondering, as a follow-up question, if you could offer a few thoughts on the relative proportion of abortions done in different trimesters. My understanding is that roughly 90% or just lower than 90% are in the first trimester, and that relatively few abortions are in the third trimester. Why do they happen normally?
Tracy, you can go ahead.
Sure. So I think that's a very good point to remember. We are now with the introduction of medication abortion. Up to about 92% of abortions occurring in the first trimester. Those rates differentiate, as both Jessica and Deborah noted, for low-income women of color who have less access to healthcare generally. Less than 1% of abortions in the United States happen after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and even fewer much later in pregnancy. Three conditions traditionally lead to a need for services that late in pregnancy. One is that the development of the fetus begins to manifest in ways that suggest that the fetus would either not live after delivery or would have a significantly compromised quality of life. So fetal development issues are one. The second is that women began to manifest. Pregnancy is, of course, harder on the body the more pregnant you become. And so women begin to manifest health conditions that are highly risky for them, heart conditions, eclampsia, that is the sort of blood pressure issues that necessitate the only treatment option for women is to make sure that she's no longer pregnant, so a termination. The third are a set of sort of tragic social circumstances where either women discover very late in their pregnancy that they are pregnant, and then a series of socially complicated issues delay their procedures. We think about young sexual assault victims in this group, so women, girls who are 12 or 13 who were not involved in consensual sex, whose pregnancies don't become noticeable to anybody, and whose mental health is thought to be significantly compromised if they continue to have a baby under these such a traumatic circumstances. Those are the sort of three bulks that make up these very late procedures. Unfortunately, I'm worried that we are beginning to see more women pushed into the later second trimester because of the stories that you heard today, because of the HIDE restrictions, because of the limitations in the availability of services, because the new waiting periods and consent laws are becoming more and more onerous, that more women are pushed into later gestations by abortion regulations, and that we're moving in the wrong direction, especially for vulnerable populations for whom price makes a huge difference and lack of availability of care.
Thank you so much. Thank you both so much. Next question, Christy.
Our next question comes from the line of Sharon Phillips from the Abortion Gang. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thank you so much for having this call. I just wanted to push back a little bit on something Ms. Reed said. I'm actually a family doctor and an abortion provider, so the problem wasn't Dr. Gosnell not being an obstetrician gynecologist. The problem was him not having the appropriate training to do the procedures. As many people on this call will know, Dr. Tiller, who's an excellent abortion provider, was a family doctor like myself. So I just wanted to clarify that. And the issue is training, not specialty. And actually, if we start to, when we start to say that only obstetrician gynecologists can do abortions, that actually decreases access in exactly the same ways we're trying to fight against.
Well, this is Deborah Reed. I appreciate your response. I was just looking at what the grand jury report said, and that is what it said. But I agree with you that the point is making sure that women have access to abortion providers who are trained in the correct way, where we see that in this case, Dr. Gosnell or his staff were not. But I appreciate the point of clarification.
Thanks so much, Sharon. Really appreciate that. Christy, next question?
Our next question comes from the line of Michael Warren from the Weekly Standard. Please proceed with your question.
Hi there. Thanks for doing this call. The article that's on RH Reality Check right now, Separating Truth from Lies Around the Kermit Gosnell Case, it cites the fact that the National Abortion Federation, which goes around, you know, certifying these clinics, didn't refused to certify Gosnell even after he kind of cleaned up his place and tried to make it look like he was doing some safe procedures when he really wasn't. But the grand jury report goes on to say that the inspector from the NAF never told anyone in authority about everything that she saw. So I mean, isn't this a problem when the National Abortion Federation isn't reporting? Is there a problem here with pro-abortion and pro-choice organizations not doing a very good job of policing themselves, or at least that community?
Jody, I'd like to respond.
Yeah.
I don't have any comment on what that particular NAF staff person did or didn't do, but I do wish to reiterate what I said earlier and what is amply documented in the grand jury report. There were repeated calls by people in Pennsylvania, by local doctors, by abortion providers in that community, begging the Department of Health to do something. So I think it's just blatantly incorrect to say that pro-choice groups wanted to keep this quiet. They didn't.
It was a pro-choice administration in the governor's office. I mean, this was you know, two successive pro-choice administrations in the governor's office. It wasn't like
it was a pro-life
regime.
I mean, it is extremely unfortunate that the Department of Health did not respond to the repeated calls of to do an inspection. There's no question of that. It was a massive failure of oversight. But I think your basic point that pro-choice groups didn't want to do anything. I mean, other providers said, shut this guy down.
Tara, let me ask Tara if she wants to respond, and then we'll go on to the next question. Tara, did you want to add anything, given your reporting and experience in the
I misheard the name you were saying. I think any there was such a complex matrix of oversight failure. The idea of cherry picking, you know, I had to actually do a sidebar listing a very long list of red flags that were ignored by everyone seemingly. So the idea of cherry picking, you know, one who knows what this one anonymous employee of one organization did or didn't do. So cherry picking that out to blame either, you know, anti-choice or pro-choice is playing into the exactly what caused PermaGuzznell to happen, which is the politicizing abortion and politicizing the case. So if we move beyond that, transcend that in order to recognize that that is the very problem itself.
Are there any questions, Christy, from anyone who hasn't yet had a chance to ask a question?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Grant Ruta from The Atlantic. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thanks so much. I guess my question is regarding the pricing for later-term abortions. It sounds like Gosnell was not using a procedure that is medically standard or well-researched. It was his own sort of experimental protocol for inducing abortion. He was doing it at a very low price. He was reportedly doing it on sort of a sliding scale, not just in terms of anesthesia, but in terms of other kinds of payment as well. And I'm wondering, why are the prices so much higher in other abortion clinics, and why do other abortion providers not have any kind of sliding scale or payment plan? Do they think that women will not ever pay the full amount if they're offered an opportunity to obtain an abortion earlier at a cheaper price and then pay for the rest of it after the fact?
Seems to me like this question should be both for Deborah and Jessica, as well as perhaps Carol and Tracy, or any one of you, actually, I think. But,
this is Carol. I would just say very quickly that, you know, I have studied abortion provision for over 30 years. I've never encountered a clinic that did not give lowered prices, in many cases free abortions. When Dr. Tiller was alive, abortion clinic staffs used to dig into their own pockets to send patients that they could not see, because typically very young, 10, 11, 12-year-old girls, victims of incest, they would pay them. The clinic staff would pay for this young girl to go to Kansas. So there's a great deal of sliding scale going on in the abortion-providing world.
This is Jessica Latina. What I would add is that 25% of Latinas live in poverty, and I think we see similar numbers across communities of color. And whether procedure is, you know, $200 or $2,000, that price could often mean the difference between putting food on the table, paying rent, paying for child care, or getting the procedure. So for us, it's really important to it's not per se about the amount. It's about kind of the circumstances of women's lives that make it so challenging to get additional procedure when there is not support from, federal health insurance programs to allow access to this important procedure.
This is Deborah Reed. I just want to reinforce what Jessica just mentioned, too, for communities of color, and particularly African-American women. And we're back again to the Hyde Amendment barriers that are preventing uninsured women, they're preventing women that are enrolled in Medicaid and other federal programs from getting access to abortion as a regular part of their health care coverage. And if you are a low-income woman, as Jessica mentioned, any type of financial arrangement can be onerous on for you. So a sliding fee scale may not be enough. You may need that procedure to be covered under your health care if you are fortunate enough to have insurance.
This is Tracy. I would just add two additional points to this conversation. The first is I think what underlies this conversation is still a mythology that abortion providers are making some sort of excessive amounts of money out there on the provision of care. Most abortion providers these days operate very close to the margin of closing, and the more that the states impose regulations, the further and further those clinics come to the margin of just being able to survive. So when women need access to either delayed payment or reduced services, most clinics try as best that they can to accommodate them, but it may mean the difference between staying open and offering services to a great range of women or just offering that one service. What we have seen over since the Hyde Amendment is an explosion of things called abortion funds. These are where individuals give financial resources, often to volunteer-based organizations who provide those resources to women to help offset the cost of the abortion, to help them with transportation, to help them with lodging. I think it's a tragedy in our country that instead of healthcare services being paid for in routine ways that we offer most general healthcare, this type of abortion has been, in a sense, privatized to either clinics attempting to do what they can to help these patients or people actually reaching into their pocket to help women access health care. And I think that's just an overall statement about how bad the politicization of abortion has come in this country.
Before we go to the next question, the only other thing, this is Jody, that I would add is that I think it's important to remember that many of the women going to Gosnell were beyond the point at which abortions were legal in Pennsylvania. So you have the situation where you couldn't get a legal abortion. And then also you have the situation where many clinics that are federally funded can't provide abortion care, so that limits access as well. So there are all of these different things that lead to a situation like this that are being pushed by anti-choice organizations to further and further restrict access to safe care. Next question, please, Christy.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to register for a question today, please press the 1 followed by the 4. Our next question comes from the line of Charlotte Taft from the Abortion Care Network. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, I'm Charlotte Taft. The Abortion Care Network is made up of independent clinics and allies, and I want to thank this incredible panel for their brilliant and very cogent comments. But I also think the voice of abortion providers is so important here. And thank you so much for the doctor who pointed out that being an OBGYN is not the important situation here, and even access to training, because I promise you, Kermit Gosnell had plenty of access to as much training as he wanted. What we're looking partly at is intention. We're also looking at the fact that the stigma against abortion creates the silence. So we're looking at both poverty and stigma that makes women who go to a place like this not blow their own whistle and not be the ones to tell other women, don't ever go here. Although I know there were lawsuits against this clinic. So, again, this was not a secret that this was not a good place to go. So I wonder if there might be any providers on the line. I know that Erin Grant has done an excellent essay on today's RH reality from the perspective of a provider, and I just think this is such an important voice to hear.
Thanks so much, Charlotte. Thanks for that important point. We try as much as possible on RH Reality Check to get provider voices and researchers, advocates, all the people working on sexual and reproductive health and justice, and we continue to reach out to providers to do that as well. And hopefully in the next week you will see more providers speaking out on this issue. If I could ask Christy for the next question.
Of course. Ladies and gentlemen, as a final reminder to register for a question today, please press the 1 followed by the 4. Our next question comes from the line of Sophia Resnick from American Independent. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. I wanted to know if one or more of you could talk a little bit more about the rising restrictions to abortion training, whether it be at, whether it be like funding to public universities to provide this training or things of that nature.
See if that's for Carol or Tracy.
Yeah, Tracy. Carol, do you want to take? Okay. This. We're seeing this at two levels. We're seeing states that have long done it. Let's say states like Missouri, where no institution receiving state funds can participate in abortion training. And then we're seeing states attempting to actually ban abortion training at any facility that receives state Medicaid. So there had been a rising in the 1980s, only about 13% of abortion of OBGYN programs trained in abortion care. And as the doctor noted, that does not mean that you need to be an abortion provider. But then the Residency Review Committee started and included access to abortion training as part, as an expected component of OBGYN care, of OBGYN training, and that rose to about then 50%. There, I think the most, the greatest example of this is in Arizona. Arizona passed a piece of legislation authorizing the building of a new football stadium, and in that authorization, which was a bargain that they made with a funder for the football stadium, they wrote into statute the long-term prohibition on inclusion of abortion training in at the University of Arizona. These are often completely not looked at. They're not paid attention to, but they make it very difficult for providers who are interested in offering abortions after after training to offer it in their practice. In family medicine, we know that that number is significantly lower. It's less than 10%. And there's been a big effort to try to increase the availability of abortion training in family medicine residency programs, but often family medicine programs are engaged with community health centers. Those community health centers often are restricted from offering malpractice coverage for people doing abortions. So it's this sort of hodgepodge, a very wonky regulation that is beginning to really constrict what had been a rising trend in the availability of training in abortion. Did you want to add anything, Carol?
Yeah, just very quickly. I mean, you know, I think the theme of everything we've been saying this morning on this call, it speaks to the extreme politicization of abortion. And, you know, we have a very good example in the question of training when, when you study abortion, the word that often comes to mind is unprecedented. In an unprecedented move, when the medical bodies that were charged with establishing standards for resident training, when they finally put in abortion training into OBGYN residencies in 1996, in an unprecedented move, Congress nullified the standard. It had never done this before. And what this meant in practical terms, if a program did not comply with this regulation set by the accrediting body, this program would not be subject to losing any federal funding. In other words, Congress was saying to hospitals, don't worry about the standard set by your professional body. We're nullifying it.
Thank you so much. We are now coming up on 1 hour, and I am cognizant of time limitations we all have, so I'm going to thank you all for your participation in the call, and again, really want to thank the speakers for their participation in the call. On our reality check later today, we will have an audio file of this conference call available for anyone that wants to listen to it again or share it with anyone else. We also have many articles by the very people on this call on this issue and many other issues. So we welcome your questions or requests for information if you have them. Thank you again for participating, and thanks to everyone who made this possible.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your line.